Birch White, a third of the members of the board resigned from it. And that included pastors of big churches in different parts of the country. They resigned from the board. And then Dr. Machen said that the seminary board must tell us and tell the world whether they stand for the independent board or not. And so I didn't think that was the right way to handle it. John Murray, who had come to us our second year, he didn't think it was. And of course, Dr. Alice didn't. So they asked the faculty to tell the board that they thought the faculty should, the board of the seminary should stand with the independent board under these conditions. It's up to you to tell us and tell the world. Murray didn't sign it, Alice didn't sign it, I didn't sign it, the other four did. And some in the board said, why don't we drop the four and keep the three? But of course that wasn't. So three-fourths of the board of the seminary left. And they elected a lot of young recent graduates. It was tragic. When you think what could have been accomplished with what could have been a great national work, and instead of that, it condemned it to a little thing like the OPC is today, and if we hadn't stepped out and started the Bible Presbyterian Church, it would be just what the little OPC is now.
Okay.
Dr. McRae, I think this has been one of the... Dr. McRae? Hello? Okay. Stephen Haig, Gloria Haig, his lovely wife. Jim Pakula, Dr. McRae. We're all together here and we've just finished making what you have heard on side A of this cassette and a little bit at the beginning of this side B. The date is Friday, September 15th, 1989, in room 28 at Biblical Seminary in Hatfield, Pennsylvania. And Dr. Alan McRae, again on side A and a beginning of side B of this tape, has given us one of, I think, the best sessions we've had since we began the oral history interviewing. It's been very profound, and we very much look forward to more of the same about these aspects of the developments in the church and at Westminster and so on, and also the biographical elements as we go back and at a later time pick up with the years in Berlin and especially those months with Albright in Palestine. So, Dr. McRae, thank you very much. We'll take up from here next time, and thank you, Steve and Gloria. Okay, it's now Friday, September 22nd, and this time we're meeting with Dr. McRae in his study at Biblical Seminary in his residence. Dr. McRae, we're going to resume this time with your 2 years in Berlin, 1927 to 1929.
Yes. Well, that starts with the fellowship that I got from the seminary. They had a number of fellowships that were given each year, but there was one fellowship which oscillated. It would be in Dr. Wilson's department of Semitic Philology and Old Testament Criticism 1 year, and the next year it would be in Dr. Davis's section on Old Testament exegesis. And the year that I was to graduate, it was to be in Dr. Davis's section. And I asked Dr. Wilson, shall I write a paper as a candidate for getting this fellowship from Dr. Davis's section? And Dr. Wilson said, don't do it. He said, don't do it. He says he might have his ideas of what you should do and so on. And he said, you're working with me and interested in the way I do things. So he says, don't do it. And I said, well, the fellowship won't be available this year. Well, he says, the Lord will provide. He says, don't bother about it. Well, I took that as meaning he thought he was the Lord's instrument in some way to provide, and so I followed his advice. Charlie Woodbridge, though, we'll talk more about later, but I just mentioned at this point that he wrote a paper for Dr. Davis's, and he took it very easy, thinking he was the only one working for it, and then he got a fear that I might be writing on it and working hard on it, and so he tried to find out from me, and I didn't let him know, which kept him rather nervous. And I'll tell about that when we talk about Charlie Woodbridge. But at the end, Dr. Wilson got, as the president of the American Bible Society, I don't remember the name of the gentleman, but he was going to give a paper to advance the research that Dr. Alice was doing. And Dr. Wilson persuaded him instead to make it a fellowship for a man of Dr. Wilson's selection to go over to Germany and study for a year. So he gave $1,000 for that. Well, Charlie Woodbridge and Ed Ryan each got one of the other fellowships available for travel in Europe. They were $600.
Yeah, I believe you mentioned
that.
Yes. Yeah.
Well, when I was with at the Friars Club at the end of the year, and I mentioned that I was going back home to see my family for a couple of weeks and then going to Germany. And one of them said, well, you're going clear out to Los Angeles. Why don't you go on around the world instead of coming back here and going to Europe? Well, we figured one way would be 7,000 miles, the other way would be 18,000. So it brought strikingly to you the size of the globe, which one didn't realize. But I went back to saw the family for a time. Then I took the train and went through Colorado. I stopped in Colorado and took a hike in the area of Ouray, Silverton, and Telluride. Wonderful area in the Rocky Mountains. I remember one day there, I was coming up to a pass in a section that's very little visited, and there was a big ridge I had to get across. And I found a way you could make it up to the top. The only place I could see you could easily make it to the top, and I wondered whether on the other side you'd be able to get down. And then I noticed a man up on the top there who'd evidently come from the other side. I said, well, if he could get up there, I can get down there. So I was safe in doing it. When I got to the top, he said, what you looking for, gold or silver? And no, I said, I just came up here for the... Oh, he says, a blankety-blank tourist. He was kind of disgusted. But the way that he had come up, I knew I could go down, you see. I got back down there and got the train. It was off the narrow gauge that came up over Marshall Pass. And when we got to the train there, there was a... good morning. There was a this narrow gauge stopped at this little station. I got on, and somebody mentioned that there were two or three hikers, girls, who had just gotten on the train a little before. And I sat next to one of them and found that she was on her way to New York to study or to work in Bellevue Hospital in dietetics department. And she mentioned her name was Adele Davis. And they were only on for about half an hour. She found I was going to Europe, and she said, I'll come over sometime and climb one of the Alps with you. Well, a year later, I got back to New York, and the boat landed. I was going to be there all day, and I didn't know a soul in New York. And I thought I had the day to wait, and I was kind of thought it'd be nice to see somebody. All the folks on the boat had gone off to their friends and everything that I'd been on with for the last 10 days. And I remembered her, and I phoned Bellevue Hospital, and they said, oh, she went to such and such a place. She left here and went to such and such. And then I called them, and she had left there and gone. But I traced her down, and she invited me up for dinner. And she said, well, she says, I'll maybe see you next year. I'm going to make a trip to Europe. So just about one day from that time, she called at my apartment in Berlin. And we had a day in Berlin together. And we said, well, the next time we meet, we'll have to be in China. Well, I didn't see her again. Ever. But about 10 or 15 years later, I was on the Santa Fe going to Los Angeles, and the train always stopped an hour in Kansas City. And they had a very fine bookstore down there. And I dropped down into the bookstore and was looking over books, and here I saw books written by Adele Davis. And I said, well, I guess this is our third meeting. And, of course, she became very famous as a dietitian, and her books on eating and eat and grow well, be well and all that put me quite a splurge for a time. She died about, I guess, 20 years ago, didn't she? Yeah. But that was an interesting little incident on the way. And then I took the boat then in New York, and at that time they had made a section of the book they called Tourist, and this was the old steerage section. Well, I got a in Los Angeles. We got a reservation, and they said it's not. They said it's on the outside of the boat, and we thought that'd be wonderful to be where you could see out over the water, you know. Well, when I got into the boat, you went down and down and down and down. And then you had to leave the little corridor and go clear off to the side here. And here was a little room about big enough to go from me to the bookcase there, and just long enough for a bed, a little more in the washstand. And there was a bed and then an upper bed. And there were four this way in that little tiny room. And all of us, they sold outside cabins, you see. And actually, it was so low that it didn't have any window. The outside there just had a covering over the outside. Well, it was terribly crowded. Only one person could stand there to wash or anything, but out of the bed. But the next day, two of them went and got switched to other places in the boat. So that there were only two of us left in the boat. The other fellow was one of the characters I would be least interested in knowing of all I've met in my life. But he and I, though we shared the same cabin, we each kept pretty much to ourselves, as far as the other was concerned. But this tourist section had a lot of people who were going back to visit their friends, a lot of immigrants. There was one minister there who felt it was his duty to try to make everybody happy, and he organized little games and things. And he organized a little thing where different people would do stunts and so on. And I had memorized a little piece by Stephen Leacock on my experience with banks, which I thought was very, very comical. And I had memorized it, and so I gave this reading of this, and these folks just stared, not a laugh of them. Made you feel rather foolish. Because among most people I know, that one would have provoked hilarious laughter. But we had about 9 days on the boat getting over there. And it was, on the whole, quite an interesting experience. But we landed in Bremerhaven, and from there we went down to Bremen, a short distance away. And then some people I know and I were going on to Berlin together, and they I got a porter and asked him, I had a lot of baggage, and asked him to take it to the train for me, which he did. And he stuck it in a car. The others all go in a different car. And after the train started, I found the car I was on was going to go about 3/4 the way to Berlin and then be shunted off and taken down to Leipzig. So I had about 4 or 5 big heavy things, and there was about 5 cars up to where the other people were, including the dining car. And so I had to get my stuff up there before it would get to Leipzig, before it would get to the place where they switched. And so each time we stopped, I would jump off and grab a bag and try to run and get on up above. And an official called, saw me, and he yelled something about strafe, punishment, you know, and so on. And I knew very little German, and I'd had 2.5 years of German in high school 10 years before. Why, after that, I didn't try to carry any more that way, but I carried up through the diner and through all those cars. But I got it all up there before we got to Berlin. Well, when we got to Berlin, they in the station, the porter picks up my bag, one of my bags with it, this one, and broke the handle. We went to a little hotel, the Lehrter Hotel. This was the station, the Lehrter Bahnhof, where the train stopped. And when I got there, I showed to the hotel people what had happened to it, and they said they'd get it fixed for me. And the next day, they had it back, and I asked how much it was, and it was 30 cents to fix a new handle on there. A year later, I was in Paris when the same thing happened. Man in the station picks up the bag and breaks the handle off. I went to the hotel there. I was on my way back. 2 years later it was. And I asked him at the hotel. Oh, they said, we get that fixed. So they took the case. I was there 2 days in Paris. And the third morning, it was time to go to the train, to the boat. And I got downstairs, and there they had the case, and they hand me the bill, and bill for the night, 2 nights, had an addition fixing the case. I guess $3 for fixing the case, and then it was in the bill, so 10% for service was added to it. And the contrast with Germany struck me very forcibly. I said to the man, well, I said, that's a ridiculous charge. So he says, that's what they charge. Well, I said, can I, I said, I'm going to go and see those people. I said, oh, it'd take you all day to get to them. They're way off, he says. And I couldn't do anything. So finally I said, well, give me the case. Give me a bill leaving this out altogether. And he gave me a bill for the just for the nights, and I said, we'll take care of this separately. Well, I went upstairs and packed, and I just felt I was going to go, no matter what they said I was going on. But when I came downstairs, they said, oh, they said, we got in touch with those people. They changed it to 50 cents instead of $3. Of course, those was in francs. So the contrast between France and Germany was very impressive. And I think the reason for it is the general attitude of the people toward travel. I don't know how it is now, but the way it was then, the average French person thought that France was such a lovely place, and especially his town, that anybody that comes here from a distant place must be something wrong with his place. And if he takes that attitude, there must be something wrong with him, so he's fair game to get anything out of you can. Whereas in Germany, everybody wanted to travel. And if they didn't have any money, they would pack up a little food and stuff in a little bag and start off and walk around the country for 2 or 3 days. But everybody wants to travel. And the result is they meet somebody from another country. They always want to know something about his country, and they're glad to do anything to help they could to help him. And so I don't think it was that one was meaner than the other, but they had a different background attitude. Well, we stayed at this hotel our first few days, and I looked around I was going to look around for a place to stay. Is it time for 1 year?
It's about.
Yes. And I should mention that I met a man on the boat, and he invited me, a German. He had been in America for 4 years, and was going back to visit his family. And he told me about his struggles with the American language. You know, in Germany, you say thank you, the answer is please. please don't mention the children. They just say please, or they say pretty please, or many pleases. But he said he didn't know what to say. So he went up to a man in a park and said, would you please give me a match? The man handed him a match. And he says, thank you, and listen closely and see what the fellow's saying. And he said, you bet your sweet life. She said he puzzled over that for a while. Well, I went to his house, and he and his family, they were very pleasant. I knew very little German yet. But immediately they brought out a glass of whiskey. I said, no, thank you. And they brought a glass of cognac, and he said, no, thank you. And they brought a glass of beer, and I said, no, thank you. And finally, they brought a box of chocolates. And I thought, oh, well, this is all right. So I took a chocolate, and it was full of brandy. But this fellow had a brother who was a very attractive fellow, and it's a very interesting thing. My landlady, I got a place just two doors from them, and my landlady used two German words quite a bit. The word nett and the word hübsch. And she told me that one of these brothers was very nett, but not hübsch. The other one was very hübsch, but not nett. Well, as far as I could ever figure out, hübsch means pretty, but you can apply it to a man too, so it means handsome. While nett means nice. And those two words were very common. It was interesting to get the contrast between them brought out in that way. Well, this fellow found me a place just two doors from there. But I moved in there. The landlady had the place, and I moved in. And I only saw anybody from that home once more all the time I was there. I ran out of this fellow on the train once, about 6 months later, and we had a nice little chat. But they weren't the type that I was particularly anxious to make friends with there. But I found this place they found for me with a landlady. And I used to, you'd go in the front, you had a great big key to get in to the courtyard. And then you go back through this, and there was a front house and one on each side in the back. And then there was this open courtyard in the middle. And you'd go back to that place, and the back one then, you would go in and press a button. And that turns on the light in the halls. And the light would stay on just long enough for you to get up to your place. And then it would go off automatically. And then you'd come to the apartment. And I had to have two keys for the apartment. You had to unlock one, and then you had to unlock the other. And I wrote my folks about that. And my mother wrote, oh, how nice it was to think of me with all those keys there. Well, shall we go? All right, then. I was mentioning I had the German I had was in high school 10 years before this. I'd had 2.5 years in high school 10 years before, so I had forgotten most of it. And the first day in Berlin, I went to the university and heard a lecture on recent tendencies in education by the famous Professor Schronner. For 2 hours, and I caught two words, of and but, for 2 hours. But I got to work and worked hard on the language. Dr. Machen once said, learning a language is always hard work. But he said, learning it in the country where it's spoken is a lot of fun in addition to being hard work. And it certainly was that way with this. And I put a great deal of time on trying to get the German pronunciation and trying to get the nuances of words and so on. And I talked German on every occasion I could, talking with Germans or even when I was with American students. I found a funny thing in learning the language. If I was talking English, German words would come in. They creep in all along. But if I was talking German and I didn't know a word, I was just stuck. The thought just never occurred to me to introduce an English word in the middle of it. A strange thing of memories. Another thing I noticed was that I was if an American visitor would see me and want me to show them around the world, why, I would be talking to my friend in English, and then we'd go into a store somewhere, and I would be translating for them into German back and forth. Well, when I got back to this country, they landed us in Boston, and we had to get tickets to New York. And there were some German folks I'd become acquainted with on the boat, so I tried to help them in the details. And there, I would speak to the clerk, and I should speak to that in English, and to my friends in German, and just reverse what I was used to. And it was the hardest thing to you. Turn to the official, and the German words would come, and you had to stop them and speak English, and then turn to your friend, and the whole tendency was to speak English, and you had to switch. It illustrates how our minds get in a certain groove, and how hard it is to change. Well, I practiced, as I say, whenever I could, and so when I was with American students, I would talk German all I could. And I remember one time a fellow had come just Germany quite recently, and he didn't know much German yet. And we walked along, and we were talking, and I talked to him in German all the time. He would answer with effort in German, because he didn't know a great deal of it. And we happened to pass a place, and I said, I got a friend in here. I said, let's stop and say hello. So he said, all right, we went in. And this was another American student. And I spoke to him in German. We kept on talking in German. And he also hadn't been there as long as I had. And both of them were struggling with the German. And it was after 10 minutes that each of them found out the other was from America. And they were ready to crown me for not used English from the start. But I went to the I signed up for courses at the Institute for Foreigners, and there they had people from many different backgrounds, different nationalities who were wanting to learn German, and they started in reading a story. In each day we would have some part of this German sort of a novelette. And they would discuss what they'd read and so on, and that was good practice in Germany. And then I went into the American Express. I got all my mail through the American Express there. It was sort of a meeting place for Americans in Berlin. And I went, what was I going to say?
Talking about the American
Express. Oh, yes, I went in there, and I went up to the desk. I maybe was changing some money or something, I forget, or asking some direction or something. I looked up, and right next to me, there was Dr. McCartney, who'd been the moderator of the church, you know, in America. He was there. And beyond him, there was a young fellow I'd met over here named Henry Willits, and beyond him was Dr. Ells. And I was surprised to see them. I'd been maybe 2 or 3 weeks. And I spoke to them, and Dr. Alice was going back to America after 5 days. And I thought, that's a strange thing. And I said to Dr. Alice, I said, what are you doing? I said, you're just staying here for 5 days. And he said, yes. And he hadn't been, he had studied there years before, but he hadn't been there for years. I thought, that's a strange thing, to come just for five days. And then I was with Dr. McCartney. I said, Dr. Alice, just staying. I said, are you all going back after 5 days? Oh, no, we're not, he said, Dr. Alice. Well, I said, what's he going so soon? Well, there's somebody on the boat he'd like to be with, he says. And it proved out that Miss Robinson, who was the secretary at Princeton Seminary, and who had taken dictation from several of the people who were very strong for preserving the seminary and not turning it over to the modernists, and had become very much of a, a party member of those who wanted to preserve the seminary, and who developed a strong antipathy to Dr. Erdman and Dr. Stevenson, who were trying to change the seminary. that she had done a lot of work for Dr. Alice. And now she'd been in England for, I guess, 6 weeks, and she was coming back, and he wanted to come back on the same boat with her. So he went over there for 5 days and got the boat back. And I heard, I guess it was a month later, I got word that they had gotten married, he and she. And as he told me, he wanted to get married the next week, and she wanted to wait until June. So they compromised on making it the third week instead of the second. But I heard later, after I got home, how they had a big wedding there in Miller Chapel, and Dr. Alice and or Miss Robinson and the other women were in the back somewhere, and she heard later that Dr. Erdman, she asked, do we have to invite Erdman and Stevenson to our wedding? Oh, yes, they said, we got to invite the whole faculty. Couldn't possibly invite them. She didn't want to have her wedding. But she found out later that Dr. Erdman went and stood in the vestibule in the entrance to the chapel and greeted everybody. You'd think it was his affair. They said, if Miss Robinson had known that, she'd have called off the wedding. Well, of course, later on, for 7 years, they were both at Westminster when I was teaching there, and I was a very good friend of the two of them in later years. But Dr. McCartney and a young fellow named Henry Willits, who just died about 3 years ago, they were told me they were going to make a trip on down to Dresden and then to Prague and Budapest and on to Athens. They said, why don't you come along and interpret for us? Well, I did about 3 weeks to get in German, and I said, all right, I will. So I left them. I mean, I went with the two of them, and we went to, the first night we went to a hotel, and they had two beds in the room, and they put in a cot, told me to sleep on the cot. The next place we were, it was a similar situation. They got a room with two beds and told Henry Willits to sleep on the cot. So the third night, we told McCartney to sleep on the cot, which he did, and after that, we got places with three beds in one. But we went to Dresden, the first stop. And in Dresden, we went to have dinner at a place, nice hotel with a balcony overlooking the Elbe River, beautiful place. And we started into order. And one thing I didn't know much about was the German names for food. So we went through and I tried to figure out what the things were each of them wanted. And then when we got the waiter to know what each of us wanted to eat, he says, and what do you want to drink? Well, Henry Willits said he'd take a glass of beer. And Dr. McCartney, did he want a cup of coffee or something? I forget. And I asked for a glass of water. And the man said, oh, he says, this is a wine balcony. He says, you can't eat here unless you drink wine. None of the three of us drank wine. And we'd gone through all that effort of getting the meal figured out, you know, that we couldn't eat there. So we said, well, we'll have to go to some other hotel to eat. Oh, he says, you go right over to that balcony over there, he says. You can get anything you want. But he says, this is a wine balcony. You can only eat here if you drink wine. So we had to go over there and go through the whole job again, which was quite a job with a little German that I knew. But we were at Dresden one night. The next night we were at Prague. And Prague then was just after World War I. It was 5 years after. And Czechoslovakia had been under the Austrian yoke for 300 years, ever since the great reformer John Huss, 500 years ago, since John Huss had been killed and they had been forced into Roman Catholic control, you know, and the Hussites, had, many of them had to flee. And now Czechoslovakia had its freedom after World War I. And you could just feel it in the air. They were building, you know, everywhere. And, oh, it was just going ahead. And people would say, they said that Czechoslovakia, you get in the train, you get to talk to somebody, you talk about politics, they were interested in politics. You know, you talk about different things they weren't. But he said, you start talking about Christianity, everybody was just full of interest. They said it was the most marvelous situation for spreading the gospel. And we heard that we stood out on the street where there were some Salvation Army people with songs in Czechish and so on the program, and we all stood with great interest, although we couldn't understand a word they said. And pretty soon we noticed they observed our interest and they spoke directly to us. And since we couldn't understand anything, we thought that wasn't fair. So we walked on, let them talk to the people that could understand them. But oh, everything was opening up in Czechoslovakia, and for the next 20 years, it was the most marvelous opportunity for the gospel. And I was so impressed by it that I thought for a time, of, after I finished my education, going there and trying to start a seminary there, and thought it could be a tremendous field. And I used to hear missionaries who were there then and during World War II, and oh, it was such an interest in Christianity, such a marvelous opportunity. And then the communists came in and just put down all the freedom in Czechoslovakia, you know, and they've been under the yoke for these last 40 years, I guess. And I it's very, very sad what happened there. But we went on from, I think it was there that we were in a hotel at dinner. The orchestra saw we being Americans, they had some American songs. So they played them. That's Foster. My old thinking on all these, they played a lot of those. Of course, just the music, but it was very nice. So then we got to Budapest. And in Budapest, beautiful city. And Pest, Buda is on one side of the river, up on the hill, and Pest is down on the flat country. And a beautiful place, and but not many knew German. And one time we came, there was a, we tried to ask a woman some information, and I tried to talk, they too only knew English. I tried to talk in German, and after I tried for 3 or 4 minutes, she said, oh, you're trying to talk German? She said it in German, but it showed just how, what a slow point my German was at that time. There, they said, this hotel in Pest here is noted for its Turkish baths, they said. And let's have the Turkish bath. And, oh, I said, you get that and you'll be sleepy and I want to see the sights here. So enjoy the city, I don't want that. Oh, no, they said, you'll just feel pepped up. So the three of us had a Turkish bath. It was as we came out from there that we had this talk with this woman. But it did. It's the first time I ever had one, and it just pepped me up, and I felt fine. But the other two were so sleepy they couldn't stay away. It was really funny. But I learned from that that the Turkish bath, with my particular constitution, it did me a world of good. And for years after I was back here, I used to have every week, and they did me a world of good.
What is it?
It's, oh, you don't know what this, a Turkish bath is a place where you go and you sit in a room with about 150 degrees temperature. And they used to have one downtown, the Kamak Baths, which started just a year before I settled in Philadelphia. And you go in this room. They had the women on the second floor and the men on the first, and you'd go in this room and you'd sit there with a temperature about 140, 150, and the sweat would just pour off of you. And one of the men once said, he says, if you stay in this room for an hour, they'll give you a Cadillac. Of course, he meant in the funeral procession. Well, I would stay there 20 or 25 minutes. Most would only stay 10. It always did me good. I guess it was just my particular constitution. They closed the place about 3 years ago. And it only started a year before I went the first time.
Like a Finnish sauna?
Yes. Well, the Finnish sauna, there they called the Russian. I don't know why, but they had a room like the Russian place. And I would go in there, and there they had these things you'd lie on, like birds. And they had somebody with a sort of like a feather duster with feathers over your back. I only took that very few times. I was a Turkish country. And then I would have massage. All of those massages did me good. And I used to try to get the hardest, toughest massage I could. Once I took Carl McIntyre with me to it. And I thought, I love the hard massage, so I told the masseur, I says, give him a good massage. Carl says afterwards, he says, I feel as if I'd taken a beating. He never went back. Of course, that's getting bad in a few years. This was in Budapest, and I decided then, there weren't many that talked German in Budapest. In Czechoslovakia, there were quite a number, and of course in Dresden, but I was over there to learn German now, and so I thought it's my duty now not to go further, so I left them. And they went on to Athens, and they wrote me and said, oh, I should have heard Dr. McCartney on Mars Hill reading Paul's speech at Athens. That would have been great, but that wasn't what I was there for. So I could be their translator, but couldn't any further than this. Probably shouldn't have gone quite that far. But I got into Budapest and found they were having a convention of the Christian Endeavor of Europe. Which over there, the Germans changed the letters around. Christian Endeavor was very extensive at that time in churches all over America. And I think it's pretty well died out now, but it was a real force in those days. And Christian Endeavor, started by Father Endeavor Clark, a congregation minister, was in most of the denominations. And over there, they called it Enchidnus Christendom, so they use the letters EC instead of CB, and it means out and out Christianity, which I like better than Christian Endeavor. But they had a big representation, about 60 people from England here, and they had about 200 Germans had come for it, and they had people from other countries. And I heard about that, and I thought, well, I'll attend these meetings. So I went, and that's where I was from. Signed up, and I told America. Oh, they were happy to see me. They said, and they named, what's the name? He was one of the leaders of Christian Endeavor in the United States. He was expected for the meeting, and he hadn't gotten there yet. And that evening, they were having a big meeting, and they were introducing, somebody was representing all the different countries and shake hands with the mayor of Budapest, and the man from America hadn't shown up, and here I was from America. Would you represent America? So I said, all right. So they had the people come up and shake hands, and when they had the man from Czechoslovakia, they said, that poor mayor of Budapest, he's got to shake hands with a man from Czechoslovakia. It's not awful. But he shook hands very pleasantly. But I went up and shook hands with him, was representing America. The regular man got there the next day, so my job was finished. But at that program that evening, they sang Hungarian various songs, and then they sang what at that time I thought was our American anthem, My Country 'Tis of Thee. And I understood that to be the American anthem. Later they changed it to Star Spangled Banner, which I think is miserable, because the other was a really fine thing that expressed sentiments. And this is, except for one line, just rah, rah, our country. So I think it's terrible we switched. But then, when they all sang this, then I recognized, I stood up, you know, and so did everybody else. So the next day, I saw these, I was talking with some English people, and I said, why? And they said, that was nice when they sang that last night. Oh, yes, they said, God Save the King. It was the same tune. And then we found out it actually was the tune of the Hungarian National Anthem. So that was quite an experience there at Budapest. But then I took the train back. Back from there to Berlin, and I met some of the German people from the ECs, you know, there. And later I went to some of their meetings. I got back to Berlin, and here I'd had about 3 weeks in this course of German, you know, for foreigners, and they'd been reading this story. Well, now they had the final, they had one more week, I think, and then they had the final examination. And of course, I'd paid for the course, but I'd missed 3 weeks out of the middle of the 6 weeks course, so I thought it'd be silly for me to attempt to pass the examination, but after all, what's at stake? So I said, all right, I would try. So they dictated some stuff, and we wrote it down. And I haven't got it. Is that all right? Yeah. Well, so the man, when he got to me, he saw Alan McCrae, Princeton University, or Princeton Seminary. No, I guess they had me registered for university, because you had to show in order to enter the university, you had to show a certificate that you had graduated from a gymnasium, and that's the equivalent of 2 years of college in America. But I had just gotten my MA from Princeton University, so I gave him my diploma for the MA. So he had me down at Princeton University, and the man says, oh, yeah. He says, Princeton, he says, that's where they don't let them drive automobiles. Of course, in Germany, practically nobody was driving an auto then. At that time, there was one auto in America for every six people and one in Germany for every 200 or something like that. There were very few autos in the street. But the man says this, he said, I'm not from the university, though. I'm from the seminary. And I said, the fellows in the university have great, big, beautiful machines, and they're not allowed to drive them. And I said, we in the seminary have little cheap Fords, and we can drive them. And he kidded back and forth with me. And they gave me a certificate that I knew enough German to enter the university. And one of the fellows who stayed and worked real hard in the course, they gave him a certificate which said that Mr. Paul Cotton does not know enough German to enter the university, but he knows enough to be allowed to take the next course at the Institute for Alzheimer's. Well, I took the next course anyway. I knew I needed it badly, but I thought that just showed how these people were all tense. Am I going to pass the exam? Well, I didn't care a snap whether I passed it or not, because I could take the next course anyway, and I knew I didn't know enough German to enter the university yet, but of course I had the rest of summer working. Even that, I didn't get near as much out of my university the first semester as I did later on. Well, maybe that's enough. I thought, to us, like, see, there are so many details, you know, at times that it's hard to pick out. And then a lot of it is not as, it runs together in your mind 50 years later. And that makes it hard on the historical part. I remember the personal parts, of course, the details and all of that a lot. You want to turn on
Okay, this is Friday, September 30th. with Dr. McCrae and his study, and we're just going to go into a little bit more detail of the history of Westminster this afternoon. This is Stephen Haig interviewing Dr. McCrae.
Dr. McCrae?
Yes. The history of Westminster. Well, I wasn't present at the beginning of Westminster. During the 2 years I was abroad was when the big strife came, the big fight. And when the Princeton Seminary was reorganized, and of course the modernists said that they were making no changes, they would continue Princeton Seminary exactly as it was. And they got some fine Christian people on the board, but they were in the minority. It was the liberals that had the majority of the board, but they wanted to go on just as it was. So, of course, one important thing about it was that most of the faculty were pretty old. Machen and Alice were both right in the prime of life. Both of them were assistant professors there. And Jenkins was a young man, in his 30s, he was teaching theology. But most of the rest of the faculty were very old. And they knew that within a very few years, the whole face of the seminary would be changed. I remember during my last year at Princeton, one fellow from Canada came in to see me and wanted to see the set called The Fundamentals. And this set was published by two Christian oil men in California. And originally, I think it was 5 volumes, later issued in a smaller, more compact. But it's from them that the believers in the Bible came, quite an extent, to be called fundamentalists. And he looked it through, and he said to me, Mike, he says, there's hardly any real apologists here. He said, our big problem is we don't have many people today who are studying how to defend Christianity, defend its principles and its teachings. And the real apologists, we had very few. Well, of course, Machen was a very, very fine apologist. Before this, he had published his book on the origin of Paul's religion, which is a masterly treatment of the attempts to explain Paul's religion as other than a divine teaching to Paul. And he had dealt with it in a very fine, scholarly way, and everybody recognized that it was a wonderful piece of work. And in the modernist seminaries like it, they would say, they'd give a list of books to read for additional reading. They'd give a list of books, and then at the end they might say, if you would be interested in something from the conservative side, you might read Machen, The Origin of Paul's Religion. And of course, Dr. Machen had written his Greek grammar. He was disgusted at the poorness of the books for learning Greek. And he wrote this, in which he worked out a very fine system. And to this day, it's used, I believe, in the modernist seminaries in teaching beginning Greek. After his death, one of the modernists in an article about him said that it seemed almost superhuman the way any subject he dealt with. He had seen everything ever written on, including the most obscure monographs. But Dr. Machen, of course, was to quite an extent the ruling spirit in the forming of Westminster, though Dr. Robert Dick Wilson was just as important, and he was far better known than Dr. Machen at that time. He was, of course, had been a great scholar many years longer, and he had an international reputation and was highly regarded. And in fact, they had run him for moderator of the General Assembly, the conservatives had. The year when the liberals won and then proceeded to change Princeton Seminary that year. They ran. 2 years before, he had gone to China and had spoken all over China to mission groups here and there. But they were the two leaders in the faculty. But then they asked, Dr. Machen asked Ned Stonehouse to become his assistant. And Dr. Stonehouse had been in Holland during the 2 years that I was in Germany studying.
Did you see him there?
No. See, he was in Holland. I was in Germany.
Oh, you never met them in Europe?
I never met over there, no. But he had gotten his doctor's degree there, writing a paper, I believe, on the witness of Luke to Christ. And later he wrote similar books on other Gospels. And Dr. Stonehouse, though, had come back from there. And if I recall correctly, he had been asked to become traveling secretary for the League of Evangelical Students, and I think had agreed to take up this work. And then they invited him to become Dr. Machen's assistant, and so he resigned from that work, which he had only been at a month or two, and he wrote another of our classmates, Everett Harrison, and asked Everett to take over that position. And Everett had already been asked to join the faculty of Dallas Seminary. And Everett wrote that he did not think it was the Lord's will that he should leave the opportunity that he had of teaching in this seminary in order to do this work, finding important as the work was. And of course, Stonehouse was leaving that work to teach in the seminary. Well, later on, as they went on thinking of other members for the faculty, the thought was advanced by somebody, suppose we'd see if Everett Harrison would be a good member of our faculty. And so they mentioned that, and Stonehouse immediately said, oh no, he said, he is a mystic. You don't want a mystic on your faculty. He said, I don't think it is the Lord's will that I should leave this world, that I should leave the prospect of teaching in order to do this work. So that showed he was a mystic. And so, of course, they didn't want mystics on the faculty. So he was no longer considered for it. Well, I mention that because that was important in the beginning of the developments, just along the line of picking, criticizing Christians on what might be minor evidences, as you see. They weren't absolutely at one with him on every little point you could think of. Well, I was in Austria at the time, and the school got started, and I didn't hear of it. I'd been out of touch for 4 weeks, so when I got a big stack of mail, there was in it a letter from my folks in Los Angeles saying that they had read in the Sunday School Times that a new seminary was being started and that I was on the faculty. And they said, is this true? We hope so. Well, Dr. Wilson had assumed I would come, but he was so busy with the work that he didn't write me. And Dr. Alice sent me a telegram asking, Dr. Alice wrote me, and he said, they were hoping to start a seminary, and we'd like some books, and could you go to Leipzig and see if you can get these books for our library? Leipzig is the book capital of the world. And so I went to Leipzig, found the books he wanted, and shipped them to him. And I said, I hope I can get a third year in Europe I said, you spend a third year here, and I'd like to have a third year. And fortunately, I'd had my time in Palestine that spring, thanks to Dr. Kyle. But the result was that when I didn't get any word further, I went off on this trip for 4 weeks in the Alps. And when I got back, there was this tremendous stack of mail. And I waded through it, and I saw that the seminary, according to the date that they had set, was already in session. So I sent a telegram to Dr. Wilson. I said, letters and telegrams just received. Suppose other satisfactory arrangements made by this time. And he then sent me a wire of teaching your classes till you arrive. A salary, $2,500 a year. So I rushed and packed in Austria there and went up to Berlin and packed up my stuff and took the train to Paris and then from there to the to Cherbourg and came over. And when I got here, Dr. Wilson was already teaching my classes, which was, as I've already mentioned, much better for me than as if I had started at the beginning. During that year, the first month I was there, I stayed with the Wilsons in their apartment, and I hunted around for an apartment. Oh, I might mention, Dr. Alice had made available a building, 1528 Pine Street. Dr. Alice's father had been a physician who had accumulated considerable money and had purchased houses in many parts of Philadelphia. And so Dr. Alice made this house available for the seminary to meet in. And of course, that was a great help, having that. But they only had 50 students the first year, so they didn't need a lot of classroom space. And they had arranged for the Stonehouses to live. Dr. and Mrs. Stonehouse had a room on the second floor where there was a classroom. They had classrooms on the first floor and second floor. And so they said that I should live in... I should stay in one of those rooms they're going to make available for me. And Dr. Wilson says, don't you do it. He says, you get your own place somewhere. And I told Dr. Dr. Wilson said, with Dr. and Mrs. Stonehouse there, it would be very bad for you to room there. You shouldn't do it.
Why is that?
And, well, he had some experiences in Western Summary. I mean, it was there where people were very suspicious of all sorts of things. And it's best if I not be right there with him. He thought. Well, I told Dr. Alice, and Dr. Alice says, well, he says, Mrs. Stonehouse is due to have a child in another month. So they certainly couldn't blame you, he said. So he says, there's no reason you shouldn't have a room there. Well, I told Dr. Wilson that. Dr. Wilson says, oh my, he says, all the more reason for you to get out of there. He said, if she'll have a child, she may be deathly sick, and the child may have problems with him, and you will be the nursemaid or the errand boy for them. And he says, if you're going to do your scholarly work and your teaching right, he says, it's much better in your way. So I took a great deal of time hunting for a decent apartment and eventually got a place right across the street from the Wilsons, where I stayed for 2 years. And that was only a block and a half from the seminary, which was very convenient. Then I guess I better take a little rest. So that was a good question you asked. how long they had that, they lived there. They, after a year or two, they rented the house next door. And the street there was, the houses were solid from the street. That is, there was no space between the houses. But in back, there was a big place between the houses. And see, the front would reach this wide and the back would be narrower. So there would be two houses with an open space between them. And they rented the one on the side that had that open space, 1526. And then, but the students mostly roomed at the Gladstone Hotel, which was about six blocks away on the same street, Cross Broad Street, the other side. And they kept that as long as I was there. It was only after I left that they moved out to, and after Dr. Machen died, because Dr. Machen was very anxious to be in the city. Dr. Machen got an apartment on, was it the 11th floor or something like that, of a big building in the heart of the city, where he had a very nice apartment. And occasionally he'd have the Checker Club beat over there. And I remember one of the fellows, after two or three years, one of the fellows who graduated told out, he dropped in one day to see Dr. Machen. Dr. Machen sat and chatted with him most leisurely. And after about 15 minutes, Dr. Machen said, "Oh," he says, "if you'll excuse me," he says, "I have to catch the train in 10 minutes for Chicago." So he stepped out the door and had his suitcase all packed and everything ready, of course. But he traveled a good bit, speaking here and there. And when the fellows would have stunt night, they would speak about Dr. Machen was higher than anybody else because he was on the 11th floor. But the first year, I had much contact with Dr. Wilson, in fact, with his whole family. But he died on the second week of the second year, so that after that, Dr. Machen was chairman of the faculty. Wilson had been before. They didn't have a president. They had a chairman of the faculty. This was a reaction from Dr. Stevenson, who had been the president of the of Princeton Seminary. See, Princeton Seminary had had a chairman of the faculty for many, many years. But then when Dr. Patton retired from being president of Princeton University, they asked he had been teaching in both the seminary and the university. Seminary asked him if he could continue and be their president. And they introduced the title of president for him. And but when Dr. Patton retired completely and went to the West Indies, Dr. Stevenson was called, and he wanted to make it a real presidency, but the faculty was used to having simply a chairman of the faculty, and that, of course, made for difficulty right away. Faculty used to say at Princeton, we try to teach certain viewpoints and attitudes to the students, and then when it comes to day of prayer or commencement or other occasions where they have a special speaker from outside, the president of the seminary gets somebody in that doesn't agree with us on things and contradicts everything we've been teaching. Wasn't quite that bad, because they were people who weren't in sympathy with their desire to oppose liberals, but I don't think they got anybody who was really out and out liberal. There'd have been a revolution if they had. Stevenson was determined to change the place, and he did. And so they didn't want anything like that. So the first year, Wilson presided, and the faculty were all equal in all decisions. And of course, they were starting a new school, so that there were many, many decisions to make. And the second year, after Wilson died, Dr. Machen naturally became the chairman of the faculty. And that continued until until they sought accreditation. And then the committee that came in said they should have a president. That was sometime within the, oh my, that was within 10 years of the time we started here. So it was decades after they started there. I think I've already told about how Dr. Kuiper left to become the president of Calvin College in Grand Rapids, and seat of this Dutch group. He and Van Til were, and Stonehouse, all three were from. Except that Stonehouse had attended Princeton Seminary. And let's see what else. It came the end of the first year at Westminster. They had a ceremony at the end of the year at a commencement at which we had been nominally instructors, most of us. They made us they installed Kuiper as professor of theology and Machen as professor of New Testament and Stonehouse and me as assistant professor of Old and New Testament. And this service of installation for the whole faculty, they had made a constitution which said any professor wanting to give up his labors, wanting to cease, must give 6 months notice. And anyone who was to be dropped had to be given 6 months notice. And we all signed it publicly there, including Kuiper, who signed as professor of systematics. And about a month later, if you ever saw a group that was despondent, it was Dr. Machen and others there, because they had gotten a word from Kuiper that he had been invited to become president of Calvin College and seminary, I guess. I'm not sure about seminary. And since this was an act of God, he would not be with Westminster the next year. Well, having publicly assumed the office, and they would give 6 months' notice if you were thinking of leaving, it seemed to me a rather cavalier way to take one's obligations. And to consider an act of God if you get an offer somewhere else to drop it. I didn't say what I thought, but you would have thought the seminary was going to pieces without Kuiper's teaching. Then immediately thought of a man named Meter.
Meter?
M-E-E-T-E-R, John Meter. And John Meter had something to do with getting out the edition of Warfield's books. So they considered him as a good scholar of that. I didn't know him at all. I'm not sure I ever met him. But they were anxious to get him to teach theology. And the board realized that the money was very, very short, and the Depression was really getting a good, thorough start. They were yes, 29, and things were getting bad. And the board thought we should try to get on with the faculty we had. And they thought, though, that they needed another man, and they were anxious the board should vote to invite John Meter to come. And so they had a meeting with the board, and they had couple of the faculty were faculty representatives at board meetings. And after the meeting, Stonehouse told me how Dr. Machen had told them how much it would mean to the seminary to have John Meter on the faculty. And Stonehouse said, as he said it, he says, "I got the feeling, and I think everybody else got the feeling, there have been two great Johns in Christian history, John Calvin and John Meter." Well, the board still didn't think they had money enough for another man. And so the board voted that they would invite John Meter to come if the funds, by the time school started, were sufficient to put on another man. And so they weren't able to send a real invitation to Meter. They sent him a statement: "We'd like to have you, and we hope we can have you, and if the funds come in by then, we certainly will want you on our faculty." Well, just then, there was a man who was in my class, Princeton, named John Murray. And John Murray had gone back to Scotland and had been there for 2 years. When the conservatives all left Princeton Seminary, and the liberals, or the people that took it over, were anxious to have the world think it was continuing just as it was. They thought, if we get this young fellow from Scotland to teach theology who had high marks at Princeton, as a graduate of Princeton Seminary, that will help to assure people. So they invited John Murray to teach at Princeton the first year after we started Westminster. And John Murray immediately, I think he was in Edinburgh, was near Glasgow. Anyway, it was one of these two cities. And he went to the American embassy or legation, whether it was the consulate, even consulate, and asked for a visa to come to America and teach. And they said, well, there is there's a quota basis. All the world wants to come to America, so there's a quota basis. And they said, our quota is filled until 12 years from now. But they said, come back in 12 years, and we can give you, or they said, you can apply now, get put on the quota for 12 years from now. Well, that was quite a disappointment to him. He went back to the other one of the two cities, I think, was where he lived. I heard of a man later who had been a German who had lived in the section of Germany that was given to Poland at the end of the war. And when he wanted to come here, he was told that the quota was filled for Poland for the next 15 years. And rather than wait that long, he went to Brazil. I met him in Brazil. But Murray then visited a friend in the other place, and he told them about his disappointment not being able to come teach at Princeton Seminary. And they said, well, I don't know if he'd even heard they'd reorganized it yet. And they said, well, see, they said, they have a consulate here. Let's go there and see if we have any luck getting you a visa. Well, he says, Scotland has a certain visa. They're full, how can I? Well, he said, why don't you try anyway? So he went. And here, what had the American representatives in Scotland done? But instead of figuring the quotas were made according to the American population, the percentage of American population that had come from those countries. That was the number that come each year. But in Scotland, for some reason, the ambassador or somebody, instead of keeping track of it on the whole, had said to Glasgow, you could have so many a year, and to Edinburgh, you could have so many a year. And one of them had applications that filled it up for 12 years, and the other one hadn't had hardly any applications. So he immediately got one. So he came and taught at Princeton Seminary that year. But after he got there, he realized how things had gone at Princeton, and that while they'd only gotten in people that were generally considered as conservatives, they hadn't gotten any who was ready to really make a strong stand, and the ones they had gotten were men kind of along in years, so they'd be able to get a liberal for too many years in their place. And so I guess it was the middle of the summer when John Murray told them that he would not continue another year at Princeton. And now Westminster was needing a man for theology, so they said, let's try this young fellow. So I was assistant professor, but he was only instructor, you see. So he came on as an instructor in theology. And our faculty, the eight, five of them were married, and there were three of us that weren't. And one was Machen, who was older and was busy speaking everywhere, you know, all around. But the other one was John Murray. So the next year, John and I were sort of thrown together quite naturally that way. And we were both entertained by the Wilsons that first week or two before Dr. Wilson died. And I guess the family did entertain us afterwards. But he and I, the first year I was there, I ate all my meals with the students. But after that, Murray and I ate a great many of our meals together. So for the next 7 years, he and I were together a great deal. He was as fine a companion as I ever knew in my life. And it was a very, very pleasant companionship. But that's how it came that Kuiper wasn't back the second year. He was away 3 years, and then he came again. I don't know the details of the arrangements then, but they were glad to get him then for homiletics, I think it was. Or vice versa, I forget the exact. Yeah, it must have been, because Murray was considered as a great teacher of theology. He was full of fire, life, as a teacher and as a preacher. The very same. Had some continental or European habits that a lot of Americans wouldn't care a lot for. I don't think he smoked much, but he had nothing against smoking. He occasionally would drink a little whiskey, not much, but when you'd be with him and he'd drink some, the way it went down, you know, and some other person there would take on, and oh, they'd make faces and have a job getting down. You got the impression that it wasn't a new experience for him, by any means. And he continued as instructor for the next 7 years. Of course, one reason he continued was because he had to, everything had to be exactly the way he believed, or he couldn't possibly give his name to it. And the Westminster Confession had certain additions made by the Presbyterian Church. And, of course, the Constitution of Westminster called for their standing by the Westminster Confession in the form it had that year. And there had been one or two changes made that most people would never notice. But he said he could not take an oath to be true to the confession that had some men he didn't. So later on, they invited him repeatedly to become a professor, but he didn't as long as I was there. But he was an excellent teacher, a fine preacher, and a very fine person. And the next summer, I went to German and studied after 2 years there, and he went also. And Murray was very strict on everything that he believed. I remember we were at the Alice's home one day, one Sunday, and we had Sunday dinner there, and they were talking about baseball. Miss Alice had her favorite team, I guess, and Dr. Alice had his, I don't know. They discussed it. Murray hadn't said anything, and Miss Alice didn't like to see him left out of the country. conversation. So she says, Dr. Murray, what's your favorite baseball team? Which is like, I never discussed baseball on Sunday.
In Principles of Conduct, he enumerates his views very clearly on the Sabbath.
But there were times when if he would preach in Canada, he would go over there Saturday, stay overnight at a hotel, preach Sunday, stay overnight again, and come back. He wouldn't travel on the public. And when he spoke in South Philadelphia, about a mile and a half down, where Mr. Freeman was the pastor of the church. And the next Sunday, we were there. He and I were there for dinner with the Freemans. And, he says, I didn't bring my notes for my sermon tonight. He says, I didn't bring them. I'll have to walk back to my room at the Gladstone and get them. And, Mrs. Freeman says, do you know where they are? Can you let one of us have the key so we can get them? Because we can ride on a streetcar on Sunday. You can't. Well, he wouldn't. But the little Scotch group that he belonged to had a group in Canada. And he used to go up there somewhere. But they had a big controversy over some of their people lived quite a ways out, and the only way they could get to church on Sunday was to take a public conveyance, and the denomination said that was not happening. So, and I think the minister there wrote a pamphlet: "Can Sunday keeping prevent church going?" Which he said it would be permissible to ride on Sunday to go to church, but not for any other reason. And I think he was reprimanded by the denomination. And Murray left their group because he felt that one should have freedom to ride to go to church. So he could then have felt he would have freedom to come up to get his minutes. Notes, but he would not use his freedom. So he and I walked up. I enjoyed the walk. We walked up to there. But it was most interesting conversations. And I enjoyed it very much. And he came over to Germany there, and he had this month or two in Germany. And he stayed not far from where I was staying. And, of course, we were together. There we went to church one Sunday morning, and the German minister had what I thought was a very fine sermon. And on the way back, I made reference to different things in the sermon. John said, "Well, I'm glad you heard a good sermon this morning." In other words, his German was not particularly good, you know. It takes a year at least to get your ears to where you would understand a sermon, every bit of it. And he'd only had a month or two. He said, he says, "Isn't life strange?" He says, "One day you're trying to kill somebody, the next day you're sleeping in the same bed with him." Because he'd been a member of the famous Black Watch, the Highland Regiment that fought in France during the war, and he had a most thrilling time. He had a most miserable time when the Allies were pushing, the Germans were pushing the Allied forces back every day, back over weeks. And then the Germans exerted everything they had, and then they kind of broke. And the result was that the Allied troops began to rush forward, and they would capture as much in a day as they lost in 3 or 4 days. You see, the Germans collapsed. They had fought to the very limit, and of course the American troops were now coming. It seemed like an endless number of troops that were would be coming. Well, the Germans had used all their resources. Well, this day they started forward, that big rush forward, you know. And he got a little feeling in his eye. That, oh, he thought a little dust got in my eye or something. So he went back to the behind the lines, to the place where they had the first aid. And they looked at his eye and they said, this is very, very serious. And they shipped it back. And by night he was on a, he was on the boat heading for Britain. And he was in the hospital. And he said, after being in the trenches, he says, after fighting there, he says the whole time in the vacation, including the operation, was just a holiday. But they took out his eye. So he had only one eye. He had a glass eye in that moment. He did a tremendous amount of reading. In fact, it might be easier to do reading with one eye because your eyes have to focus for general light. But you don't learn to understand during much of 2 or 3 months. I guess one time I left, I understood just about everything. But it takes time. And, of course, the language words. And this Dr. Machen said, to learn a language in the country where it's spoken is fun. And I really enjoyed it. But we had that summer together. And he said to me, well, he says, why don't you come back to Scotland and have your vacation there? I said, oh, it rains all the time there. I think I'll go to Switzerland. Well, he may just be so used to the rain, he didn't notice it. Anyway, he said later that his month in Scotland had been beautiful weather all the time. Well, in Switzerland, it rained at least one of every 3 days while I was there. But I met a fellow in Switzerland who had been a close friend of a fellow who was my roommate in college. And this fellow was he was a very nice fellow. And I met him in Berlin, and we arranged to meet in Switzerland. And after I'd been there a week, I got to the place where he was going to meet me, and we went for, we had a week or 10 days together there. And later on, he became assistant to the president of Princeton Seminary. And some years later, I got a letter from Princeton Seminary, and they said, we are making a biographical dictionary of all the graduates of Princeton Seminary. Will you please fill this out, your education, your work, everything, and then at the end, any special honors. So this letter was signed the Reverend, what is his name? The Reverend so-and-so. And so I filled out this letter. Then on the bottom, I said, special guide to the Reverend so-and-so in the Swiss Alps in the summer of 1932. So I got a letter from him. He said, that would have been a great honor, but he hardly thought it could go in the biographical dictionary. Years later, I went with a chap